listeners, welcome to the Book Report. Yes, this weekend's calendar fills us with fear. Tax day. Hopefully most of 2011 finances are behind you. Now it's time to look ahead and investigate titles that might help make 2012 brighter, financially speaking. We'll look back at events that shaped and curdled our economy, check in with some of your favorite business authors, and focus on books with money on the mind. So, file those tax forms away for now, deep cleansing breath, and let's turn to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
No One Would Listen, a true financial thriller, was an Audi Award nominee for Best Nonfiction Audiobook of 2011. This is more than another book about the Bernie Madoff scandal. It's a fast-paced, blow-by-blow, true crime story you have to hear to believe. In a true David and Goliath tale, the underdog number cruncher uncovers the largest financial fraud in history, then has to fight everyone and everything in the system to bring it down. Harry Markopoulos and his team of financial sleuths tell how they cracked Madoff's $65 billion Ponzi scheme. Yet, shockingly, the Security and Exchange Commission refused to hear the truth for nearly 10 years. Told from the perspective of the ultimate whistleblower in modern corporate memory, No One Would Listen is the definitive narrative of this scandal. This special edition includes an exclusive 10th chapter featuring testimony from three victims of the Madoff scheme who share their stories. In addition, David Kautz, the Inspector General of the SEC, speaks candidly about his investigation. Throughout the book, you'll hear scathing commentary from congressional leaders on the blatant failures of the commission.
The news is hitting. Madoff's under arrest. It looks like he was running a huge Ponzi scheme. It's all over Bloomberg.
I hate to say it, but Bernie's pulled off the perfect crime. Bernie's got to be at least $30 billion. He's as bogus as a $3 bill.
Bernie Madoff just confessed to a $65 billion Ponzi scheme.
These innocent Madoff investors include hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of investors.
I was a Madoff investor. The SEC says Madoff is a legitimate business. Of course, we lost all our money.
Every penny that we invested is absolutely gone now, and so there's nothing. I mean, we have nothing left.
The SEC had numerous opportunities to uncover the Ponzi scheme.
With all of your investigators and all of your agency and everything that you all describe, one guy with a few friends and helpers discovered this thing nearly a decade ago, led you to this pile of dung that is Bernie Madoff and stuck your nose in it, and you couldn't figure it out.
At about 5:15 that December afternoon, I was at the local dojo in my small New England town watching my 5-year-old twin boys trying to master the basic movements of karate. It had been a gloomy day. Rain continued intermittently, and there was a storm in the air. I noticed there were several voicemails on my cell phone. That's curious, I thought. I hadn't felt it vibrate. I stepped into the foyer to retrieve the messages. The first one was from a good friend named Dave Henry, who was managing a considerable amount of money as chief investment officer of DKH Investments in Boston. Harry, his message said clearly, Madoff is in federal custody for running a Ponzi scheme. He's under arrest in New York. Call me. My heart started racing. The second message was also from a close friend, Andre Mehta, a super quant who was a managing director of alternative investments at Cambridge Associates, a consultant to pension plans and endowments. I could hear the excitement in Andre's voice as he said, "You were right. The news is hitting. Madoff's under arrest. It looks like he was running a huge Ponzi scheme. It's all over Bloomberg. Call me and I'll read it to you. Congratulations." I was staggered. For several years, I'd been living under a death sentence, terrified that my pursuit of Madoff would put my family and me in jeopardy. Billions of dollars were at stake, and apparently some of that money belonged to the Russian mafia and the drug cartels, people who would kill to protect their investments. And I knew all about Peter Scannell, a Boston whistleblower who had been beaten nearly to death with a brick simply for complaining about a $1 million market timing scam. So I wouldn't start my car without first checking under the chassis and in the wheel wells. At night, I walked away from shadows, and I slept with a loaded gun nearby. And suddenly, instantly and unexpectedly, it was over. Finally, it was over. They'd gotten Madoff. I raised my fist high in the air and screamed to myself, "Yes!" My family was safe. Then I collapsed over a wooden railing. I had to grab hold of it to prevent myself from falling. I could barely breathe. In less time than the snap of my fingers, I had gone from being supercharged with energy to being completely drained. The first thing I wanted to do was return those calls. I needed to know every detail. It was only when I tried to punch in the numbers that I discovered how badly my hand was shaking. I called Dave back, and he told me that the media was reporting that Bernie Madoff had confessed to his two sons that his multi-billion-dollar investment firm was a complete fraud. There were no investments, he had told them. There never had been. Instead, for more than two decades, he had been running the largest Ponzi scheme in history. His sons had immediately informed the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, and agents had shown up at Madoff's apartment early that morning and arrested him. They'd taken him out in handcuffs. It looked like many thousands of people had lost billions of dollars. It was exactly as I had warned the government of the United States approximately $55 billion earlier. And as I stood in the lobby of that dojo, my sense of relief was replaced by a new concern.
We've just heard "No One Would Listen" by Harry Markopoulos. It's time for our monthly visit with Robin Witten, editor of Audiophile magazine and our guru on the world of audiobooks. Welcome, Robin. So are you going to survive tax day this weekend?
Well, I hope so. You can get a lot of advice from some of the audiobooks that are about right now.
Let's talk about that. Which titles would you recommend that folks pick up to help them through this time?
I don't know. I think you need to have read them a little bit before.
I know. Okay, next year. Next year.
But you know, one of the popular financial shows, of course, is Susie Orman's show on CNBC, and I think a lot of people who watch that often will investigate some of her writings, and her books are really quite interesting. She has a new book, "Women and Money," that is recently out, and. You know, what's interesting is when you contrast a little bit of her, the personality that you see on the TV show, and then when she's actually doing a workshop or reading one of her books, the style is a little different.
Hmm.
And I think it suits the TV, the big personality part, suits TV well, and when she has guests and interviews and things. But when she's delivering some of her lessons, if you will, she has a very approachable and thoughtful way of sharing these ideas with a listener.
Well, I want to go off topic a little bit, away from tortured tax day for a moment. I noticed that Susie actually narrates a lot of her own books, but then others are done by professional narrators. Why do you think she kind of goes back and forth, and what's your opinion on that?
Well, I don't know. I think it's interesting. Usually authors, sort of stick with either they do their own books or they have someone else do them. Susie is very skilled at it. I think she's had a couple. The Money Class is one of her books that is narrated by a professional. And it may be a matter of scheduling. At a time when other things are going on in the authors' lives, they don't have time to commit to doing their own narrations. But sometimes if you have someone who is very skilled at their live communication, so you take Susie, who is, obviously she has her TV show, and then you take someone like, say, Michael Lewis, who is more of a writer who does not have although he appears in public, he's not a public speaker all the time. So in Boomerang, which is his book, you have a professional narrator, Dylan Baker, who was actually, I think, read several of his titles. You get a little bit more of an understanding, perhaps, of the text. That isn't, it's not exclusive. But sometimes you get something that's a little different, and sometimes with more complex subjects, and you're not doing a workshop style that Susie's is, but you're exploring a historical and recent cultural phenomena. You get something a little different with a professional narrator.
Yeah. So, I mean, have you ever known a case where, an author insisted on reading his own book and the producers kind of had to put a stop to it? I mean, certainly all of us that love audiobooks have heard some author-read books that we wished had been narrated by a pro.
Right. Well, I think that would indicate that maybe the author has the last word. I think authors also find that it's hard work. And they may not be, as they've often will say, this is much harder than giving a lecture. You're being corrected for your pronunciations. You have to go over lines, and it's quite a bit more difficult. But I think oftentimes, authors who are good and like their work then they project well, and that enthusiasm is quite quite important to our listening and enjoyment. And sometimes the enthusiasm will help to, and that sort of passion that the author has, may overcome some vocal peculiarities, perhaps.
Said very, very kindly and diplomatically.
Yeah. Well, one of the books that you're looking at, the Harry Markopoulos, No One Would Listen, is an interesting sort of combination of the author, a narrator who takes sort of an overall role, and then all of the interview voices that are little parts of newscasts and comments from investors who were Bernie Madoff's victims. It's really quite an interesting piece and spans something quite different.
Right. I actually noticed that your magazine Audiophile also had some features on Money Matter books this month. Do you want to just list some of them? Tell us a little about some of them.
Right. Well, we do, actually. Our feature that's called Learning by Ear, is the topic is your money and your life. And we always have reviews of several new books that are out, and including most of them actually are read by professional narrators in this case this time, and then a book list that that goes back over several years. Our editor likes to make sure that we are reminded of the best books that he knows of on the topic of financial health. So in the new reviews, we have a book by John Robbins called The New Good Life, which is interesting. He's the heir to the Baskin-Robbins inheritance, and he's sort of not followed the family fortunes and has a very interesting story to tell about money. The Ten Commandments of Money, and Debt Free for Life. I love the topic. The titles of a lot of these books are pretty interesting.
Yeah,
they get you going right at the beginning.
So readers can check up on audiophile.com.
Audiophilemagazine.com.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Robin. This is a lot to chew on to get ready for tax day and maybe be better prepared for next year. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Nice to talk with you anyway.
Bye. In 2005, Joel Greenblatt published a book considered one of the classics of financial literature. In The Little Book That Beats the Market, a New York Times bestseller, Greenblatt explained how investors can outperform the popular market averages by simply and systematically applying a formula that seeks out good businesses when they're available at bargain prices. Now, with a new introduction and afterword, The Little Book That Still Beats the Market updates and expands upon the research findings from the original book. In a straightforward and accessible style, the book explores the principles of successful stock market investing and reveals the author's time-tested formula for buying above-average companies at below-average prices. The formula is explained by using simple math, plain language, and even humor. While the formula may be simple, understanding why the formula works is the true key to success. Greenblatt takes listeners on a step-by-step journey to learn the principles of value investing in both bull and bear markets. Adam Gruber narrates.
Jason's in the sixth grade, and he's making a fortune. My son and I see him almost every day on the way to school. There's Jason in the back of his chauffeur-driven limousine, all decked out in cool clothes and dark sunglasses. Ah, to be 11 years old, rich and cool. Now that's the life. Okay, maybe I'm getting a little carried away. I mean, it's not really a limousine. It's kind of a scooter. And the cool clothes and sunglasses part? Well, that's not really true either. It's more like his belly hanging over a pair of jeans, no sunglasses, and what he had for breakfast still stuck to his face. But that's not the point. Jason's in business. It's a simple business, but it works. Jason buys gum, 4 or 5 packs a day. It's 25 cents for a pack, and 5 sticks of gum to a package. According to my son, once in school, Jason transforms himself into a superhero of sorts. Neither rain nor sleet nor evil hall monitors can keep Jason from selling his gum. I guess his customers like buying from a superhero, or maybe they're just stuck in school. But however he does it, Jason sells each stick of gum for 25 cents. Supposedly, I've never actually seen it myself. Jason kind of shoves an open pack of gum into a potential customer's face and repeats, "You want some? You know you want some," until his fellow student either collapses or forks over a quarter. The way my son has it figured, that's 5 sticks at 25 cents each. So Jason rakes in $1.25 for each pack he sells. At a cost of 25 cents per pack, that means Jason is making $1 of pure profit on every pack he can shove. I mean, sell. At 4 or 5 packs a day, that's a lot of money. So after one of our daily Jason sightings, I asked my sixth grader, "Gee, how much do you think this guy Jason can make by the end of high school?" My son, we'll call him Ben, even though his real name is Matt, started whizzing through the calculations using all his brain power and a few fingers. "Let's see," he replied. "That's, say, $4 a day times 5 days a week. So, $20 a week, 36 weeks of school, that's $720 a year. If he has 6 years left until he graduates, that's somewhere over $4,000 more he'll make by the end of high school." Not wanting to miss an opportunity to teach, I asked, "Ben, if Jason offered to sell you half of his business, how much would you pay? In other words, he'll share half his profits from the gum business with you over the 6 years until he graduates, but he wants you to give him money now. How much would you give him?"
That was The Little Book That Still Beats the Market by Joel Greenblatt. Marketers at Procter & Gamble were studying videos of people making their beds. They were desperately trying to figure out how to sell a new product called Febreze, on track to be one of the biggest flops in company history. Suddenly, one of them detected a nearly imperceptible pattern, and with a slight shift in advertising, Febreze went on to earn $1 billion a year. An untested CEO took over one of the largest companies in America. His first order of business was attacking a single pattern among his employees, how they approached worker safety. And soon, the firm, Alcoa, became one of the top performers in the Dow Jones. What did these people have in common? They achieved success by focusing on the patterns that shape every aspect of our lives. They succeeded by transforming habits. In The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business, award-winning New York Times business reporter Charles Duhigg takes us to the edge of scientific discoveries and explains why habits exist and how they can be changed. With an ability to distill vast amounts of information, Duhigg brings to life a whole new understanding of human nature and its potential for transformation. Along the way, we learn why some people and companies struggle to change despite years of trying, while others seem to remake themselves overnight. We visit labs where neuroscientists explore how habits work and where exactly they reside in our brains. We discover how the right habits were crucial to the success of Olympic swimmer Michael Phelps, Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz, and civil rights hero Martin Luther King. We go inside Procter & Gamble, Target, NFL locker rooms, and the nation's largest hospitals to see how implementing so-called keystone habits can earn billions and mean the difference between failure and success. At its core, The Power of Habit, narrated by Mike Chamberlain, contains an exhilarating argument. The key to exercising regularly, losing weight, raising exceptional kids, becoming more productive, building revolutionary companies and social movements, and achieving success is understanding how habits work.
"It wasn't a great time for me," Lisa said. "I had always wanted to see the pyramids, and my credit cards weren't maxed out yet, so..." On her first morning in Cairo, Lisa woke at dawn to the sound of the call to prayer from a nearby mosque. It was pitch black inside her hotel room. Half blind and jet-lagged, she reached for a cigarette. She was so disoriented that she didn't realize, until she smelled burning plastic, that she was trying to light a pen, not a Marlboro. She had spent the past 4 months crying, binge-eating, unable to sleep, and feeling ashamed, helpless, depressed, and angry, all at once. Lying in bed, she broke down. "It was like this wave of sadness overwhelmed me," she said. "I felt like everything I had ever wanted had crumbled. I couldn't even smoke right. And then I started thinking about my ex-husband, and how hard it would be to find another job when I got back, and how much I was going to hate it, and how unhealthy I felt all the time. I got up and knocked over a water jug that shattered on the floor, and I started crying even harder. I felt this desperation, like I had to change something. I had to find at least one thing I could control." She showered and left the hotel. As she rode through Cairo's rutted streets in a taxi, and then onto the dirt roads leading to the Sphinx, the pyramids of Giza, and the vast, endless desert around them, her self-pity, for a brief moment, gave way. She needed a goal in her life, she thought. Something to work toward. So she decided, sitting in the taxi, that she would come back to Egypt and trek through the desert. It was a crazy idea, Lisa knew. She was out of shape, overweight, with no money in the bank. She didn't know the name of the desert she was looking at, or if such a trip was possible. None of that mattered, though. She needed something to focus on. Lisa decided that she would give herself 1 year to prepare. And to survive such an expedition, she was certain she would have to make sacrifices. In particular, she would need to quit smoking. When Lisa finally made her way across the desert 11 months later, in an air-conditioned and motorized tour with a half dozen other people, mind you, the caravan carried so much water, food, tents, maps, global positioning systems, and two-way radios that throwing in a carton of cigarettes wouldn't have made much of a difference. But in the taxi, Lisa didn't know that. And to the scientists at the laboratory, the details of her trek weren't relevant. Because for reasons they were just beginning to understand, that one small shift in Lisa's perception that day in Cairo, the conviction that she had to give up smoking to accomplish her goal, had touched off a series of changes that would ultimately radiate out to every part of her life. Over the next 6 months, she would replace smoking with jogging, and that, in turn, changed how she ate, worked, slept, saved money, scheduled her workdays, planned for the future, and so on. She would start running half marathons, and then a marathon, go back to school, buy a house, and get engaged. Eventually, she was recruited into the scientist's study, and when researchers began examining images of Lisa's brain, they saw something remarkable. One set of neurological patterns, her old habits, had been overridden by new patterns. They could still see the neural activity of her old behaviors, but those impulses were crowded out by new urges. As Lisa's habits changed, so had her brain. It wasn't the trip to Cairo that had caused the shift, scientists believed, or the divorce or desert trek. It was that Lisa had focused on changing just one habit, smoking, at first.
That was The Power of Habit by Charles Duhigg. Here's a business book that's close to my heart after my 15-year career at the Miami Herald. Yes, it may be about newspapers, but be careful. This could happen to your business. That's one of the central messages of former LA Times editor James O'Shea's The Deal from Hell, How Moguls and Wall Street Plundered Great American Newspapers. This outlines how a bunch of intelligent, well-meaning industry professionals tanked what had been, just 10 years prior, a thriving American newspaper trade. O'Shea almost goes as far to suggest that if you're starting to hear the word synergy a lot in your office, you might want to think about a career change. The deal initially referred to the bizarre takeover of the Tribune Company by real estate cowboy Sam Zell, but more broadly came to refer to the merger of the Chicago Tribune and the LA-based Times Mirror. Using that deal as a prime example, the book tackles a wide range of problems that have befallen the newspaper industry in the last few decades. On one level, The Deal from Hell is about all the problems in modern American print journalism. First, the old newspaper families grew conflicted and unsure. Next, the bean counters took over. Through it all, O'Shea presents a painful step-by-step process of what went wrong and how. It's like watching a car crash in slow motion. On another, perhaps more significant level, this book is about how numbers-driven values are eroding our world at large. At every turn, managers scheme to slice costs and make cut after cut to the workforce. Rome really starts burning with the arrival of nutty Wall Street types who ride in on a tide of big bank financing. O'Shea subtly hints that it's not just the news at stake anymore, as our whole society becomes about profits and losses. The frank, honest narration of L.J. Ganser makes us feel as if we've been privy to the backroom wheelings and dealings of the business side, as well as the tense interactions of reporters on the newsroom floor.
This is not a book I wanted to write. Soon after being fired as editor of the Los Angeles Times in early 2008, numerous friends called and told me I should write a book about my experiences over the years. I must confess that I had often thought about writing a book about the business I loved. I even kept a diary recording my experiences in Los Angeles in case I wanted to reconstruct some of the events for a book. But I always thought my newspaper book would be a novel. In 2008, after several bruising years on the front lines of the newspaper wars, I had decided to put the whole thing behind me and try something else. Maybe help with a political campaign, or take various menial jobs to write a book about work in America, or maybe resume my interest in photography, or ride my bike from Belfast to Beirut. Then I began thinking that no one had reported and written about the troubles confronting my craft from the perspective of a working journalist. And that's what this book is. A view of the media maelstrom from a journalist who worked in the trenches for more than three decades and loved every minute of it. I make no apologies for my biases, and I make no excuses for the fact that I am first and foremost a reporter. As I began thinking about the disaster that has struck newspapers, I realized I really didn't know what had happened, even though I had a front-row seat running the newsrooms of two major American newspapers, the Chicago Tribune and the Los Angeles Times. I set out to report and write exactly what happened, without fear or favor. It would be easy to condemn the people who caused this modern tragedy as venal and evil. Thousands of friends and colleagues the world over have lost jobs because of the way the industry has been managed. Some were venal, all right. But most of the people who led newspapers to this point in history were smart and thoughtful. They thought they were doing the right thing. And that's what makes the story of what happened so terrifying. It shows this disaster could happen to anyone in any industry.
That was The Deal from Hell by James O'Shea. We Are All Weird, The Myth of Mass and the End of Compliance by Seth Godin is a celebration of choice, of treating different people differently, and of embracing the notion that everyone deserves the dignity and respect that comes from being heard. The book calls for the end of mass and for the beginning of offering people more choices, more interests, and giving them more authority to operate in ways that reflect their own unique values. For generations, marketers, industrialists, and politicians have tried to force us into little boxes, complying with their idea of what we should buy, use, or want. And in an industrial, mass market-driven world, this was efficient, and it worked. But what we've learned in this new era is that mass limits our choice because it succeeds through conformity. As Godin, who narrates, identifies, a new era of weirdness is upon us. People with more choices, more interests, and the power to do something about it are stepping forward and insisting that the world work in a different way. By enabling choice, we allow people to survive and thrive.
Rich is my word for someone who can afford to make choices, who has enough resources to do more than merely survive. You don't need a private plane to be rich, but you do need enough time and food and health and access to be able to interact with the market for stuff and for ideas. The Swami, pictured on the cover of this program, is rich. Not because he has a fancy house or a car. He doesn't. He's rich because he can make choices and he can make an impact on his tribe. Not just choices about what to buy, but choices about how to live. Human beings prefer to organize in tribes, into groups of people who share a leader or a culture or a definition of normal. And the digital revolution has enabled and amplified these tribes, leaving us with millions of silos, groups of people who respect and admire and support choices that outsiders happily consider weird, but that those of us in the tribe realize are normal, our normal. My argument is that the choice to push all of us toward a universal normal merely to help sell more junk to the masses is both inefficient and wrong. The opportunity of our time is to support the weird, to sell to the weird, and, if you wish, to become weird. The battle of our time. It's not between men and women, or the left and the right, or even between the Yankees and the Red Sox. The epic battle of our generation is between the status quo of mass and the never-ceasing tide of weird. It's difficult to not pick sides. Either you'll want to spend your time and effort betting on mass and the status quo and trying to earn your spot in this crowded mob, or you'll abandon that quest and realize that there are better opportunities and more growth if you market to and lead the weird. Two decisions you'll need to make within the hour. One, do you want to create for and market to and embrace the fast increasing population that isn't normal? In other words, which side are you on? Fighting for the status quo or rooting for the weird? And number two, are you confident enough to encourage people to do what's right and useful and joyful, as opposed to what the system has always told them they have to do? Should we make our own choices and let others make theirs? Part 1. Capitalism, industry, and the power of mass, and its inevitable decline. It's not an accident that our instincts, expectations, and biases are organized around honoring the masses. We shun the outliers, train students to conform, and reward companies that create historically efficient mass market products. The mass market redefines normal. The mass market, which made average products for average people, was invented by organizations that needed to keep their factories and systems running efficiently. Stop for a second and think about the backwards nature of that sentence. The factory came first. It led to the mass market, not the other way around. Governments went first because it's easier to dominate and to maintain order if you can legislate and control conformity. Marketers, though, took this concept and ran with it. The typical institution, an insurance company, a record label, a bed factory, just couldn't afford mass customization, couldn't afford to make a different product for every user. The mindset was, this is the Eagles' next record. We need to make it a record that the masses will buy, because otherwise it won't be a hit, and the masses will buy something else.
We've just heard We Are All Weird by Seth Godin. The New York Times best-selling Freakonomics was a worldwide sensation, selling more than 4 million copies and maybe changing the way we look at the world. Stephen Jay Levitt and Stephen Jay Dubner return with Super Freakonomics, and fans and newcomers alike will find that the freakquel is even bolder, funnier, and more surprising than the first. Super Freakonomics challenges the way we think all over again, exploring the hidden side of everything with such questions as, how is a prostitute like a department store Santa? What do hurricanes, heart attacks, and highway deaths have in common? Can eating kangaroo save the planet? The authors mix smart thinking and great storytelling. By examining how people respond to incentives, they show the world for what it really is: good, bad, ugly, and in the final analysis, super freaky. Stephen Dubner narrates.
Remember, people respond to incentives, and despite the common perception, economists and journalists are people too. We discussed how the money should be divided. Almost immediately, we came to an impasse, for each of us insisted on a 60-40 split. Upon realizing that we each thought the other guy should get 60%, we knew we'd have a good partnership. So we settled on 50-50 and got to work. We didn't feel much pressure writing that first book because we genuinely thought few people would read it. Levitt's father agreed and said it was immoral to accept even a penny up front. These low expectations liberated us to write about any and everything we found worthwhile, so we had a pretty good time. We were surprised and thrilled when the book became a hit. As profitable as it might have been to pump out a quick follow-up, think Freakonomics for Dummies or Chicken Soup for the Freakonomic Soul, we wanted to wait until we had done enough research that we couldn't help but write it all down. So here we finally are, more than 4 years later, with a second book that we believe is easily better than the first. Of course, it's up to you, not us, to say if that is true, or perhaps if it's as bad as some people feared our first book might be. If nothing else, our publishers have finally resigned themselves to our unyielding bad taste. When we proposed that this new book be called Super Freakonomics, they didn't even blink. If this book is any good, you have yourselves to thank as well. One of the benefits of writing books in an age of such cheap and easy communication is that authors hear directly from their readers, loudly and clearly and in great number. Good feedback is hard to come by and extremely valuable. Not only did we receive feedback on what we'd already written, but also many suggestions for future topics. Some of you who sent emails will see your thoughts reflected in this book. Thank you. The success of Freakonomics had one particularly strange byproduct. We were regularly invited, together and separately, to give lectures to all sorts of groups. Often, we were presented as the very sort of experts that in Freakonomics we warned you to watch out for, people who enjoy an informational advantage and have an incentive to exploit it. We tried our best to disabuse audiences of the notion that we are actually expert in anything. These encounters also produced material for future writings. During a lecture at UCLA, one of us, Dubner, talked about how people wash their hands after using the bathroom far less often than they admit. Afterward, a gentleman approached the podium, offered his hand, and said he was a urologist. Despite this unappetizing introduction, the urologist had a fascinating story to tell about hand-washing failures in a high-stakes setting, the hospital where he worked, and the creative incentives the hospital used to overcome these failures. You'll find that story in this book, as well as the heroic story of another long-ago doctor who also fought poor hand hygiene. At another lecture, to a group of venture capitalists, Levitt discussed some new research he was doing with Sudhir Venkatesh, the sociologist whose adventures with a crack-selling gang were featured in Freakonomics. The new research concerned the hour-by-hour activities of street prostitutes in Chicago. As it happened, one of the venture capitalists, we'll call him John, had a date later that day with a $300-an-hour prostitute who goes by the name of Allie. When John arrived at Allie's apartment, he saw a copy of Freakonomics on her coffee table. "Where'd you get that?" John asked. Allie said a girlfriend of hers who was also in the business had sent it to her. Hoping to impress Allie, the male instinct to impress the female is apparently strong even when the sex is already bought and paid for, John said he'd attended a lecture that very day by one of the book's authors. As if that weren't coincidence enough, Levitt mentioned he was doing some research on prostitution. A few days later, this email landed in Levitt's inbox. "I heard through a mutual acquaintance that you were working on a paper about the economics of prostitution, correct? Since I'm not really sure if this is a serious project or if my source was putting me on, I just thought I would put myself out there and let you know I would love to be of assistance. Thanks, Allie."
That was Super Freakonomics by Stephen D. Levitt and Stephen J. Dubner. 28 Business Thinkers Who Changed the World by Reimer Rigby is a guide to the people who have fundamentally reshaped their industries and the way we do business today. Some of these game changers are great intellectuals, while others are gut instinct types. Some are motivated by the desire to change the world, while others are driven by money and power. Rigby profiles the top business brains of our time to reveal the humans behind the headlines and how they've changed the global business landscape. From Oprah to Mark Zuckerberg, Peter Drucker to Steve Jobs, find out how they made it, the risks they took, and the legacies they leave behind. The title is narrated by Colin Mace.
The list also has a strong U.S. bias, but that shouldn't surprise anyone. The 20th century, the century in which the modern world of business was made, has been largely a US century. And most of the business world's seismic changes, from automation to outsourcing to the dot-com revolution and the financial crisis, have had their genesis in the United States. For nearly 100 years, the greatest concentration of wealth and entrepreneurial talent the world has ever seen has been American. Had this book been published in 1911, it would probably have been dominated by the British. And were it to be published 100 years hence, Indian and Chinese business people could well dominate. There's another reason too. It is perhaps the nature of Anglo-Saxon capitalism that leads it to produce so many influential people. Capitalism, as practiced in the United States, has two notable attributes that set it apart. Firstly, it's very winner-takes-all. This tends to produce highly visible heroic figures who are venerated above all because they represent, more or less, the capitalist American dream. Places like Europe and Japan do have their hugely influential business people, but they tend to be far lower key, and there is a far more consensual, collegiate culture. Britain, as ever, sits somewhere in the middle. US capitalism is also extraordinarily disruptive, especially when compared to somewhere like Japan. Old paradigms die quickly and new ones rise to take their place. Again, this tends to produce heroic figures. These factors are both strengths and weaknesses, but capitalism practiced this way does tend to throw up more iconic figureheads than its other variants. If it's hard to pick game changers by their actions, then what about trying to pin down their attributes? For instance, one might expect that to be a great business thinker, you need to be extraordinarily clever. And there's no doubt that some of them are, especially those in clever industries. The Google duo, Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, are all undoubtedly extremely bright people. Yet being clever is not a prerequisite. The old cliche that a lot of business is not rocket science has more than a grain of truth to it. In many industries, there are extremely successful individuals who probably score very highly in terms of emotional intelligence, but are not especially outstanding in terms of their brains. As Sir Martin Sorrell says, business isn't brain surgery, is it? Rigby, 2004. So too with background. It's tempting to think that the Rockefellers of our age either rose effortlessly from gilded launch pads or clawed their way up from desperate poverty. Sometimes it's true. Oprah Winfrey grew up in very difficult conditions in the Deep South, and there are those on the list who, as the saying goes, were born on third base. But equally, there are plenty of middle-class backgrounds out there too. Great business thinkers are drawn from all walks of life. The BBC's Robert Peston, 2009, has talked about the entrepreneur's wound, which suggests that an awful childhood, which one is constantly running away from, can be the key to success. Again, there is some truth to this. The swashbucklingly ambitious are not necessarily happy or motivated by what could be described as healthy ambition, and their victories may well be at the expense of others. People who are very successful are often slightly or hugely screwed up, says former Granada chief Jerry Robinson, Rigby 2004. Something in that drive is negative. It could be looking for something that's not there. It could be fear of failure. I mean, look at someone like Murdoch. What the hell's he doing it for? Is another deal going to make any difference? There ought to be some learning in life. But you can be a game changer and be well balanced.
For every Sam Walton, there are people who have achieved huge success and do seem to be genuinely happy. Richard Branson is forever moving on to the next thing, yet his drive seems to be bound up in a kind of permanent cheerfulness. And others, ranging from Buffett to the Google pair, seem pretty happy with their lot.
That was 28 Business Thinkers Who've Changed the World by Rymer Rigby. Okay, ladies, this one's for you. Susie Orman's Women and Money, Owning the Power to Control Your Destiny. So, why is it that women, who are so competent in all other areas of their lives, cannot find the same competence when it comes to matters of money? Susie investigates the complicated, dysfunctional relationship women have with money with her signature mix of insight, compassion, and soul-deep recognition. She equips women with the financial knowledge and emotional awareness to overcome the blocks that have kept them from making more out of the money they make. At the center of the book is the Save Yourself Plan, a streamlined 5-month program that seeks to deliver long-term financial security. But what's at stake is far bigger than money itself. It's about every woman's sense of who she is and what she deserves, and why it all begins with a decision to save yourself. Susan Deniker narrates.
I never thought I'd write a book about money just for women. I never thought it was necessary. So then why am I doing just that in my 8th book? And why now? Let me explain. All my previous books were written with the belief that gender is not a factor on any level in mastering the nuts and bolts of smart financial management. Women can invest, save, and handle debt just as well and skillfully as any man. I still believe that. Why would anyone think differently? So imagine my surprise when I learned that some of the people closest to me in my life were in the dark about their own finances. Clueless, or in some cases, willfully resisting doing what they knew needed to be done. I'm talking about smart, competent, accomplished women who present a face to the world that is pure confidence and capability. Do you mean to tell me that I, Susie Orman, who make my living solving the financial problems of total strangers, couldn't spot the trouble brewing so close to home? I don't think I'm blind.
We've just heard a sampling of Women and Money by Susie Orman. From Michael Lewis, the number one New York Times bestselling author of The Big Short and Liar's Poker, among others, comes Boomerang, Travels in the New Third World. The tsunami of cheap credit that rolled across the planet between 2002 and 2008 was more than a simple financial phenomenon. It was temptation, offering entire societies the chance to reveal aspects of their characters they could not normally afford to indulge. The trademark of Michael Lewis's writing is to tell important and complex stories through characters so outsized and outrageously weird you think they have to be invented. And you'd be wrong. In Boomerang, we meet, for example, a brilliant monk who has figured out how Greek capitalism could save his failing monastery, a cod fisherman who, with 3 days of training, becomes a currency trader for an Icelandic bank, and an Irish real estate developer so outraged by the collapse of his business that he drives across the country to attack the Irish Parliament with his earth-moving equipment. Lewis's investigations of bubbles beyond our shores is so brilliantly, sadly hilarious that it leads the American listener to a comfortable complacency. Oh, those foolish foreigners. But when Lewis turns a merciless eye on California and Washington, we see the narrative is a trap baited with humor, and we understand the reckoning that awaits the greatest and greediest of all debtor nations, us. Dylan Baker narrates.
In Kyle Bass's opinion, the financial crisis wasn't over. It was simply being smothered by the full faith and credit of rich Western governments. I spent a day listening to him and his colleagues discuss, almost giddily, where this might lead.
They were no longer talking about the collapse of a few bonds. They were talking about the collapse of entire countries. And they had a shiny new investment thesis. It ran roughly as follows. From 2002, there had been something like a false boom in much of the rich, developed world. What appeared to be economic growth was activity fueled by people borrowing money they probably couldn't afford to repay. By their rough count, worldwide debts, public and private, had more than doubled since 2002, from $84 trillion to $195 trillion. "We've never had this kind of accumulation of debt in world history," said Bass. Critically, the big banks that had extended much of this credit were no longer treated as private enterprises, but as extensions of their local governments, sure to be bailed out in a crisis. The public debt of rich countries already stood at what appeared to be dangerously high levels, and in response to the crisis, was rapidly growing. But the public debt of these countries was no longer the official public debt. As a practical matter, it included the debts inside each country's banking system, which, in another crisis, would be transferred to the government. "The first thing we tried to figure out," said Bass, "was how big these banking systems were, especially in relation to government revenues. We took about 4 months to gather the data. No one had it." The numbers added up to astonishing totals. Ireland, for instance, with its large and growing annual deficits, had amassed debts of more than 25 times its annual tax revenues. Spain and France had accumulated debts of more than 10 times their annual revenues. Historically, such levels of government indebtedness has led to government default. "Here's the only way I think things can work out for these countries," Bass said. "If they start running real budget surpluses." "Yeah, and that will happen right after monkeys fly out of your..." Still, he wondered if perhaps he was missing something. "I went looking for someone, anyone, who knew something about the history of sovereign defaults," he said. He found the leading expert on the subject, a professor at Harvard named Kenneth Rogoff, who, as it happened, was preparing a book on the history of national financial collapse. "This time is different. 8 centuries of financial folly," with fellow scholar Carmen Reinhart. "We walked Rogoff through the numbers," said Bass, "and he just looked at them, then sat back in his chair and says, 'I can hardly believe it is this bad.' And I said, 'Wait a minute. You're the world's foremost expert on sovereign balance sheets. You are the go-to guy for sovereign trouble. You taught at Princeton with Ben Bernanke. You introduced Larry Summers to his second wife. If you don't know this, who does?'" I thought, holy, who is paying attention? Thus, his new investment thesis, the subprime mortgage crisis, was more symptom than cause. The deeper social and economic problems that gave rise to it remained. The moment that investors woke up to this reality, they would cease to think of big Western governments as essentially risk-free and demand higher rates of interest to lend to them. When the interest rates on their borrowing rose, these governments would plunge further into debt, leading to further rises in the interest rates they were charged to borrow.
We've just heard a sampling of Boomerang by Michael Lewis. Readers, I hope today's business-centric show will help you focus a bit on the year ahead. I found these titles to be fascinating, thought-provoking, and entertaining. For thoughts on other titles you'd like to pick up, visit my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining us today. Send those forms off to the IRS, then get back to more pleasurable pastimes, like picking up a great book. See you back here next week on The Book Report.